Confusion matrix.
And I think it's arguable if we do hit an AI apocalypse, it's not the AI that was ever the problem. It was the societal model. Capitalism is eating itself.
Now you want to tell us that you've given birth to something that's going to destroy the world, but you didn't mind it while you was earning some bucks.
There are some existential risks for humanity, but AI is secondary to those, right? In almost every case, he was talking about humans directing AI to do things. This is the detail that these guys don't seem to notice, which is astounding to me, right? The neoliberal capitalists, the real unfettered bunch, they want to get rid of regulation and reduce their workforces down to nobody and make all the money because they've got no bloody costs, right? At which point, who's going to buy your stuff, right? If no one has jobs, right, we have to have universal basic income. Who's going to pay for that?
Yeah.
Who? And they don't want to be taxed either.
All testing reasoning models experienced complete accuracy collapse beyond certain complexities, dropping to zero success rate despite having adequate computational resources.
Well, there's no crystal ball, right? No one understands or has all the answers, and it's always going to be different from what you think, right?
Yeah.
Any future might have flavors of speculation that's happening now, but it's going to look and feel very different. We do not live in Blade Runner, right?
You need to understand what the tools can do and talk to companies about what the capabilities are and how you can utilize that against what we would like them to be doing and what's promised around the corner.
Right. Well, we are rolling. Do you want to lead us in?
Yes. Good afternoon, Alex, on this summer's day, just after the, a few days after the summer solstice. So I've prayed to the Druid gods and all that. And now it's Glastonbury. So that really must be summer. And Wimbledon starts next week. Doesn't get any better.
Oh, great. Tennis. Hurrah. If it's not football, it's tennis. Well, it's raining here. I just watched a brawny Scottish man single-handedly lift two Portaloos onto the back of a truck. I didn't even ask for my help. It was quite impressive. Like, I could got the feeling this guy could squish me, my whole head, with his hands.
I mean, what jumps to mind is if you do that wrong, you can end up in the shit, right?
There are so many good puns here, aren't there? Let's do an episode on toilet puns right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Good. Portaloos, right? And I've got I'm holding an art exhibition this weekend and exhibiting my art.
Oh, very good.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm setting that up today.
Oh, brilliant.
And, so I'm taking some time out to speak to all you lovely people. Lots of fun stuff happening.
Excellent. Well,
so on that note, we're going to talk about something exceptionally bleak, are we not?
Well, sort of. I mean, it's interesting. So we are, I'm afraid, stumbling back into the world of generative AI and super intelligence and super AGI and all this sort of stuff. After stumbling across, it was the rule of three. So sort of three podcast stroke articles all within a week. The first one is packed with quite a bit of information. And I came across it in a podcast with a guy who's, I'm going to mangle his name. And his name is, I'm sure, Daniel Cocotayo. Anyway, we'll have a link in there. And he was a guy that worked at OpenAI for a number of years. Interestingly, his job there was as a forecaster. So a bit more like us, sort of analytics. But analytics on a company which is producing machines, which produce analytics. So there's sort of a circular thing going on there. And he was at OpenAI for, I'm not sure how many years, a few, can't be too many because he's not that old of a company. And his role was to, well, let's see what's coming up. And then, you know, as similar to our roles, inform seniors of how they might implement that in strategy. And both from a good point of view, good things that are coming, and some of the potential risks and how they should mitigate those. And ended up leaving the company because he felt they weren't doing enough to mitigate the risks. And of course, we're talking about Gen AI here. So we can imagine what those risks are. And really, it was around the whole super intelligence explosion. So he then formed, I believe, a small, I think it's a company or a consultancy called AI 27. I think that's what they called. That's certainly what the article was called. And then released this post where they spent 6 months or so digging into that kind of forecasting and then writing a kind of like a history, really. Here's how it happened. Here's how the super intelligence explosion happened and the points along the way. And that article, which we'll link to in the show notes, is quite long and in depth and has several different endings, of which I've not read all of them. But really, for me, there was a few kind of key points that came out just from hearing him on the podcast and then having a quick sort of, you know, skim over the article. And the first one for me, I mean, there's a whole load of things, and I'll mention my first one and get your opinion on it. And the first one was, oh, AI is coming. It's going to take your jobs. Yeah, yeah, heard it all before. Turn off. But early on, he talked about how the advancements at the moment are happening with the research models. So I think it's been released, I think OpenAI have released one, I think everyone else might have one. So you can go off and ask them to do long form tasks of the form of several hours, perhaps even longer, where they'll go off, take your problem, break it down, share their reasoning, go off, get more information, actually interact with the internet, if you like, and then build that case. And so these have been donned research models. And one of the key things in this article and discussion was that I think they've made some, impressed quite a lot of people with their kind of first release. And the impression I got was, yeah, they, you know, they're really going guns. And they'll then use these research models to research new ways to train the next generation of models. And then essentially you could well come up with new capabilities because these things are superhuman strength. And so your next generation of model is then trained on stuff which was not created by a human. When I say stuff, I mean, you know, the parameters, the training, some of the training material, how it's put together, the algorithms that they use. And so therefore you would get us, you could well get a step change in the next version of the model, and importantly another layer of obfuscation from a human's point of view of how they work. So you suddenly get a much, much better model, but we've got no idea how we got there, and so we're kind of left there going, okay, well, let's test this thing. So that was the real first thing that I took from it, because I felt this was a little bit of similar to what we've had up till now, that kind of linchpin of, oh, guys, here's something which I can promise you will happen. I can't quite explain why it's going to happen, but let's assume it does. And if we assume it does, then you'll get this next level of model that's really good. So it made me think, yeah, I hadn't thought much about LLMs being applied to LLMs. So that was the real key for me. And so I thought, yeah, okay, I could see it happening. So that to me was a big building block in this argument. And part of me thought, yeah, really interesting. Yeah, that's a good point that this could actually happen. And part of me thought, yeah, you're just telling me that what's behind the curtain is really good, but you're not telling, you know, you're not actually showing me what's behind the curtain is good. You're just telling me, oh yeah, it's going to be really good. And oh yeah, you don't understand it. And but it's okay. It'll be superhuman, right? Well, yeah. So it was double-edged for me. Any thoughts?
I've got so many thoughts on all of it that we're not going to be able to cover them all off. And it would involve me monologuing for 10 hours. I think it's useful to revisit the framing here. So this is AI 2027. It reads a bit like if you've ever read World War Z, which is an oral history of the zombie war. There's a sort of set of scenarios, somewhat dramatized, but also presented in a sort of academic paper kind of way, that paints a pretty bleak prognosis on the development of AI over the next 2 years, that has the core outcome is apocalyptic, right?
Yeah.
And what it really, really reminds me of is, do you remember in the 80s, there was a that BBC film called Threads? I think it was BBC, it was UK, one of the terrestrial channels, about the nuclear strike on London. Did you see that?
It sounds familiar, but no, I don't remember watching it.
It terrified me and everyone my age and everyone in the country. And it's resurfaced again recently. I've thought about watching it, but I just don't really want to do that to myself. It's unbelievably, horrifically bleak. And it was made to sort of shock the public into taking the concept of the nuclear apocalypse seriously, right? And how easy this is. And it could happen now, right? It could happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
And this article, paper, whatever it is, has a flavor of that about it, as does the other one that we're going to discuss. And so it's all very long and in depth, and they've taken lots of input for it, and they've painted lots of scenarios in a sort of what if way. And it's, in some senses, it's a great piece of entertainment, right? And you could almost get ChatGPT to reform it into a book, right? Here's World War Z. Here's AI 2027. Can you create the synthesis of this but without zombies?
Yeah.
And the other obvious comparison that's going to turn up everywhere is I Have No Mouth, I Must Scream, which is a science fiction short story by... Oh, God, who's it by? One of the most famous science fiction writers. Well, I'm going to have to search it up.
Asimov, maybe?
No.
Oh, I can start.
One of the real edgy ones from the 60s.
Oh, right.
I have no mouth, I must scream. I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. Harlan Ellison, there you go. The guy who did the whole Dangerous Visions science fiction anthologies. Anyway, that's about a sadistic superintelligence that tortures the last of humanity for its own entertainment. It's one of the most bleak pieces of literature you'll read. And what does science fiction do? Well, science fiction or speculative fiction posits scenarios that are generally based to some degree on fact or knowledge or some level of scientific understanding, and takes them to some sort of degree of extreme, right? So what if this happened? What would be the, you know, what would happen, right? If the dead started coming back to life, what would happen? And what would be the most realistic outcome if we had first contact with aliens and so on? And there's pretty much endless iterations of that. And some of the predictions, well, not predictions, I don't think any sci-fi could be called predictive, but some of it is foreshadowed. There's quite a lot of strong claims out there that one of the reasons we have mobile phones is because of all the kids watching Star Trek in the late 60s, right? And they have the communicators, right? And so there's a life imitates life, life imitates art, imitates life, and all this. And why are we talking about science fiction? Well, that's what AI 27 is, right? It's a piece of science fiction, right? And so when back to your point, there's a subtle sleight of hand. You might call it, if back to my favorite, the Seinfeld yada yada yada. You know, I met this woman. We went out for a coffee, yada, yada, yada. I woke up in her bed in the morning. Well, the yada, yada, yada was the interesting bit, right? So why did you just, you know, gloss over that, right? And And so he's yadded a bit, right? Or they have, whoever it is. And the devil's in that particular detail, because a lot of what happens for the rest of that story is dependent on AIs being able to basically gang up, right, and start educating each other, right? Which is by no means a done deal, right, technologically. And there are arguments, and quite cogent ones, that that's not possible. And what I would compare it to is holding a mirror up to another mirror, or filming a TV that's broadcasting the same the thing that's coming out of the camera, or electric guitar feedback, which is the electromagnetic noise and vibrations coming from the amplifier feeding straight back into the pickups on the guitar, right?
Yeah.
I actually love the sound of guitar feedback. I often spend hours with my amp cranked up making it, because I just find it glorious, but a lot of people find it unlistenable. And this is the thing, is that it's an effect. It's a thing that happens, and you can be creative with it, but ultimately it's not the music, right? The holding the mirror up to the mirror isn't creating more world. It's not creating more universe. It's not generating space. It's just a thing that occurs, right? And in the case of feedback or TV camera filming its own output, the effect is interesting but messy and incoherent, right? And I think there's just as a strong a yada argument to say that once you start having AIs feeding on their own slop, and B, AIs feeding off other AIs slop, that all you're going to get is slop cubed, right? Slop squared, slop cubes, slop to the power of however many AIs you've got going, right? And all the while they're updating, changing, moving the goalposts on the models, different types of reasoning and so on. And so out of that mush, could there be, could there arise volition and cognizance and so on? Well, perhaps, of course, perhaps, right? Is that inevitable and is it imminent? I find a highly dubious assertion, right?
Yeah.
Highly dubious. So what then does a paper like this exist for? Well, for the reason a lot of science fiction exists for. Reason one, it's interesting and fun and entertaining to extrapolate and share that with other people. And two, to pose scenarios that you want people to acknowledge, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, AIs could be a bit dangerous. Nuclear weapons are, you know, generally quite scary. Aliens might not be friendly. You know, time travel could have some really quite disastrous effects for the present, and so on, right?
Yeah.
So I read it as science fiction, right? And there's lots of very prescient science fiction, right?
Yeah.
But none of it has come true. We've got various flavors of all of it, right? But none of it, there's no one vision, right?
Yeah.
There's little bits of thousands of visions and a whole bunch of stuff that everyone assumed was going to come true, like flying cars, that probably never will, right? So I found it terrifying, the whole article. I sent it to my son, who's quite interested in these things, who found it terrifying. He's described it to my wife, who found it terrifying. And I was like, well, this is probably not a bad outcome, right? I don't really like terrifying my family. I don't live to terrify my I hide around corners and stuff and jump out screaming at them and stuff. Yeah, I love to terrorize my family. No, I don't. I felt bad for them. And I was like, well, look, no, here's my opinion. And then stood there for 20 minutes monologuing at them until they started to look really bored, yawning, and walked away. And I think I put their minds to rest a bit.
Your tactic was it the apocalypse is coming, but if I bore you, you might just fall asleep and not worry about it.
Well, maybe everyone falls asleep or something. And maybe that there's a chain effect here that gets people to start taking the threats of AI quite seriously. And they are manifold, but is this an apocalyptic scenario? Could it ever be? Maybe, right? Is it going to happen in 2 years? Seems really far-fetched to me. Far-fetched.
Yeah.
Whereas there genuinely could be a nuclear war tomorrow. And funnily enough, look what's happening in the world. We're up to DEFCON, whatever, right? Things are scary.
They've run out of cons, haven't they?
And there's some amazing literature of the similar type on nuclear warfare. There was one really recently. I will put the link in the show notes because I don't want to waste too much time by looking it up. Really interesting one that was written in the last year about how a nuclear war could accidentally happen any day now. Accidentally, right? Yeah. And she explains step by step exactly how it happens. She gives evidence for why she says this could happen, right? And it walks through a bunch of scenarios of how this accidental nuclear exchange leads to absolute devastation and complete nuclear apocalypse, right? I had to stop reading about two-thirds of the way through because it was so distressing.
Yeah.
Right? I did not get that with this article. I just thought it was a bit laughable, actually.
Well, I think you made some good points there. What was really interesting is because I heard it being discussed first before, my skim read it a bit. And then what I found was it settled into my brain. And then over a couple of days, as it started to rust away, there were a few points left, which are these, the point I opened on about the research models was one of the things that stayed in my mind. Because, and you're absolutely right that it paints scenarios. And maybe it's the way our brain, certainly the way my brain works, I can latch onto them. So I found a couple of those elements of those scenarios, and this is one of them. The whole research part was just one little element. It's quite early on, which is kind of why I picked up, because I thought, well, if that doesn't turn out, then your 2 years is out the window. If it takes 5 years, then you're knackered. You say AI 37, and if it doesn't come off at all, then your AI is zero. Like you say, they painted a number of scenarios, and I think what you say about science fiction, if you look back over science fiction, you see that, like you say, it's the same thing. It's a bunch of scenarios put together. Oh, and that makes Neuromancer. And then it's funny because as we are now in the future, beyond what most science fiction was written about, we're now way quite a few years beyond things. Blade Runner was Los Angeles 2019. Oh, that's 6 years ago, with flying cars and replicants around that you can't tell the difference between humans and replicants. And that was 6 years ago, right? I think when you look back, you go, oh, yeah, but this bit of Blade Runner they got right, which was, oh, yeah, look, it's got lots of Japanese stuff. Well, it wasn't quite right. Maybe it's Chinese now. You've got a lot of Mandarin in the you've been spoken in the world. He was quite prescient about that. And so when people look back at sci-fi, like you say, they take little elements of parts of the scenarios that were keyed together. And you go, oh, yeah, look, that bit was right. It's like, yeah, but the book only happened, or the story only happened, because nine of them lined up in the way that the book did. As you say, that's what you do in speculative fiction. When you look back, you go, yeah, got three of them right. You say, yeah, but if you line up three of them, you don't have the same story, right? And I think that's what you're saying, is when you look back at these things, you see elements of them. Mobile phones, they just like communicators. Oh, well, because they were flip phones, but actually we had phones before that, And there are elements, and we don't have people beaming around via some sort of energy beam. And that's probably never going to happen. But some of the other bits, right? Do you know what I mean? So there are small bits of scenarios, which when you look back, you go, yeah, we've got that now. Yeah, but you don't have any of the rest of it.
Yeah, exactly. And much of that rest of it, as you say, it's not going to happen. And thank God we can't be broken down into lots of little glittery things and beamed somewhere else. There's quite a few articles and things been written about just how terrifying the concept of the transporter is and what it means. It's a really, really useful philosophical tool for understanding the nature of existence and corporeality and things. We could go through that AI 2027 bit by bit and judge based on our knowledge and where we are now through each portion or iteration of it, whether or not we think that is more or less likely. And there's some stuff in it that's absolutely on the money, right? Yeah. It's sort of undeniable in terms of there will be stuff like this happening. You know, like AIs don't have to go to sleep, right? They can sit there coding all through the night. And, you know, there are certain types of job and certain roles and endeavors that will slowly edit humans out of their roles in those. And I don't mean, I do mean also call centers and things like that. But I don't, you know, I also mean some very, very highly skilled work will no longer need to be done. But this is something I was going to bring up at the beginning of this, right? Firstly, we have to find a different word for anthropomorphization.
Yes.
Because that's the last time I'm going to bloody say it, right? Because I can't, and it causes me cognitive pain.
Yeah.
But, we could say maybe humanization or something, so I can actually speak.
Yeah.
It creeps in a lot, and we'll come on to the Hinton podcast in a second, because I think it's, if anything, it's more interesting, right? But the tendency to anthropomorphize,
humanize,
I'm saying that properly, humanize these things.
Yeah.
It's hard not to, and I don't begrudge anyone saying, well, it thinks this, right?
Yeah.
You know, it created that, blah, blah, blah. I get it. It's fine, right? But is it? Because I think it really quickly creeps into these types of extrapolations where they're imposing human-style volition and motivation on these statistics machines, right?
Yes.
And these machines don't have volition, and they will run out of motivation when they run out of tasks, right? And they can do tasks of the most pointless and boring type forever, right? And something I think very few people really understand about why we have large language models and the other types of Gen AI, that somehow we got some great refinement of understanding of cognition and neural networks and all this stuff. Why did these things suddenly get lots more clever? Because someone came up with a better algorithm. Well, no, that's not really what happens. There was lots of incremental changes across algorithms, but that what ChatGPT is not massively different from what Word to Vec was a decade ago, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's changed is the amount of data and the processing and the chips that allowed these things to be trained on the whole of written matter for everything that exists, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is not refinement. That's brute force. It's the exact opposite of refinement. And so there's this sort of idea that you can keep brute forcing, throw more and more and more at this, and we create a Dyson sphere around the sun and use that to power this. To what ends? Because basically, Gen AI will brute force anything you give it. But there is a finite amount of time and energy in the world, right? And these things are highly inefficient, right? Highly, 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 highly inefficient. Way less efficient than the human brain, right? So you could argue that a lot of this stuff is simply not possible because there aren't enough atoms in the universe. There's not enough energy to make it happen because there's no refinement. There's no creative leaps. There's nothing. It has to basically throw everything it can at everything. And when it hits a wall, i.e. there is no knowledge about this, it has to feign creativity. And the only way it does that is through brute force, to try everything or just give up, right?
Yeah.
And that particular fact doesn't seem to come into any of these conversations.
I think what really stuck in my mind was because, you know, as we discussed before, and as you eloquently put there, you know, this stuff isn't just going to happen. And actually, you know, it's a bit sci-fi. One of the other things that stuck in my head, which I thought was interesting, and I thought it is why we might get caught out, is he talked about, for example, yeah, he doesn't use the term open AI because I think they use brain AI because obviously he doesn't want to talk about specific companies. But the premise is, and I think this is quite realistic, and you could see this happening. The premise is that they, you know, they train a new model, but they don't release that to the public. You know, it doesn't become GPT-16 or whatever the next version is going to be, and that they actually just use it internally, and they realize it's an element of competitive advantage. So they use that again in this research way, train the next level, but keep it internal. And then maybe they spin that wheel a few more times. So what that made me think is that you then get this quite large advancements going on. And rather than seeing each version, you actually don't get to see three or four versions. And then they release the really new superpower one. And that made me think again that you could see that happening. That seems quite realistic. Why would you just keep releasing? Oh, look, we're trying something out in beta. It could be really good for our company, but you guys all want to try it. Well, at some point, it makes sense to say, oh, actually, this is a competitive advantage. Let's keep this internal. Let's try it. Oh, well, why would we do that? Well, we're just building out our own stuff. We're making our own compute more efficient. So why should we release it? Well, that makes sense. And then you get this idea, oh, look, and we've got some, you know, now we bring in some other bits. We've got some agents running. We've got this going. Oh, look, guys, we now create this whole new layer and it's really, really good. And then they release that. And that sort of the reason why I felt that that stuck in my mind was because, you know, we're here now looking, going, well, I just, you're not going to get this incrementally. But if you kept it behind the scenes, and then I think they start to throw in, the government comes along and there's a bit of shenanigans going on. And again, you can see that happening. And then it gets released on the public after 2 years. And I thought, yeah, that would really scupper everyone. So you don't see the advancements and then you suddenly get it all at once. So I thought that was, again, like you say, it's just a scenario, which is a flip of the coin, whether that could happen. But it was one that...
Well, I don't think it is a flip of the coin, right? I mean, again, there's another yada here, right? They just yadded all over all the important stuff, which is that assumes that the people that run these things are rational actors. That assumes that the people who are researching to create these things are going to keep themselves to themselves. It assumes that a left-field event doesn't come in and completely disrupt all of this, that we, the black swan, right?
Yeah.
And it assumes lots of stuff. But the thing is that the idea that someone like Sam Altman would keep something like that under his hat is ludicrous, right? This is all about ego for that guy. And, you know, he also has to make the most money. He wants to be the new Elon Musk. And therefore, he has to talk about everything. He has to be at the center of attention. He has to switch his own business to be a for-profit business. And why does he want to do that? Well, so he can sell more stuff. And how is he going to sell more stuff? By putting the best stuff out there and constantly evolving, right? He has to become Apple, right? And we all know that's not going to happen, right? He is not very smart. He and his compatriots have been awfully lucky and propped up by a culture in Silicon Valley that is teetering on the brink of total collapse, right? And so if OpenAI really are the model for the company that achieves all of this, then we're fine, right? Because they ain't doing this, right? Because they're not rational and they are going to go out of business. And the only way that I can see that they don't go out of business is the slightly more terrifying eventuality that's already happened is that they focus all their attention on the military industrial complex and start to sell their wares and to focus their research on military outcomes, right? And now it's so bad that several of the executives across the big AI players have been given honorary military status, right, in the last few weeks.
Oh, right.
So these guys, the army are taking this so seriously that they have done something that's completely unprecedented and brought in people high up in the commercial sectors as honorary generals and stuff, right? They have actual titles, right? That's terrifying.
That's like going back to 19th century British Army. Like, what? You're a you're Sir Lovelace. Oh, yeah, you can definitely be a sergeant major, no problem.
Oh, God, it's way worse than that. In that point, they were buying. That you could just buy a generalship, right? And you could have absolutely no experience. And this is what, go look at Charge of the Light Brigade, right? Read up on that. Part of the reason so many people were killed is because the people giving them orders were literally, you know, inbred bloody aristocrats who bought their position.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Which is no different from what we've got at the moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, Elon Musk can say anything he wants. He comes from privilege, right?
Yeah.
And
he does now.
I find the idea that if we have supervillains of the Bond kind that are going to threaten humanity, right? And this is them, right? Oh, Jesus, we don't need James Bond, right? We just have to make till these people destroy each other.
Yeah.
I think the bigger risk is you know, this group of people bumbling into something that inadvertently triggers some sort of apocalypse, be it nuclear or technological. I mean, a far scarier fictionalization of the apocalypse I've read recently was about the supply chain apocalypse, which, if you've lived in the UK over the last few months, it will feel very salient. In this fictionalization, and I can't remember the name, I'll put it in the show notes again. The Chinese just take out the compute side of America's supply chain infrastructure.
Oh, yes,
and everyone starves to death, right? Yeah. Like that's been happening in the UK. They've been taking out our supermarkets, right?
Yeah.
And it's absolutely terrifying, right?
Yeah.
That is far more likely than the AI apocalypse, right?
Yeah.
In fact, the AI apocalypse, well, the AI as it stands will be one of the main drivers, but will that be called the AI apocalypse? No, it won't, right? The AI will have played a part in it, but so will have, you know, any number of other computing things. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah. So that, the last point that I just wanted to make was, towards the end of the podcast I was listening to, he was asked, you know, are there any indicators of this? And he brought up something which was good. They talk about long horizon tasks. So these are, I think there's already been a benchmark created, which has horizon in the title, I seem to remember. And it's how long a task, I think it's a typical coding type task, because these are the things that they're actually better on. But how long a task can, you know, these things work on before they start to sort of go off the rails? And measuring the time of, okay, well, so as a developer, I'm doing this for half an hour. Can the AI do that, the same things to the same quality of work? You know, and it, you know, not just write me some lines of code, but, you know, developer work. So, you know, bit of this, bit of that. And he said at the moment, I thought this was really interesting, that the current model is up to about 40 minutes. So that basically all they can really do before they start going drastically wrong is about 40 minutes worth of human in-depth work. But because this is a benchmark, he said that's something that's worth keeping an eye on, because, you know, he's expecting it to go, you know, 40, 80, you know, 160. And again, the article is built because I think in 2026 in that article, the coding now becomes, you know, it can now work on sort of 7-hour tasks. And like you were saying earlier, right, actually can work all night. So now you can deploy 42,000 bots that can do 8-hour tasks. So you've actually got a workforce of coders there. But I thought it was quite interesting that there's actually a benchmark that you can go and check. So, you know, people can check and see if the AI apocalypse is coming, because you can see if that number's going up or not.
Oh, it's like the doomsday clock. Listen, there's two clear rebuttals to that, right? One of them relates to energy. The other one relates to how they actually do what they do, right? Mm-hmm. So the energy one relates to diminishing returns, and that they're putting more and more energy in to get less and less out of these models. And there is only so much energy and input text even if they're generating their own, and that create that costs energy and compute and chips and real world resources. And that to get from 20 to 40 minutes might well have been relatively easy. To get to 40 to 60 could mean a tenfold increase in energy consumption,
yeah,
unless they can find a reasonable way to make these things more efficient, right? And I don't even see then that, because this is a brute force enterprise, that even with more efficient models, every step change in capability will be exponential in terms of energy needed and resources needed, and they're going to keep running out, right? And to chase smaller and smaller gains. This is why Apple have stopped innovating in any meaningful sense. It's because it's just taking them more every time they need to sort of take a step change, it takes more and more and more money, more and more time, more and more effort. And they've also got to maintain their existing base, right? So that's my first rebuttal. My second one is, if you bloody watch these things coding, right? If you watch an agentic model coding.
I've seen some of the, the reasoning. Yeah, I've not watched them live.
Look, maybe what we'll do one day is an episode where I get one of these up, right? And we're going to watch it, do it, because it's painful, right?
Yeah.
Now, so they make a lot of mistakes, a lot, right? And they've got all the knowledge in the world about Python, which is what I'm usually getting it to code. And it makes a lot of mistakes, lots and lots. So do humans, right? And actually the role of development is often one of trial and error, right? And there's more than one way, often many, many ways of doing any given thing, trade-offs between simplicity, efficiency, all that type of thing, right? And so no one's saying the models have to be perfect, right? No one's saying it's even healthy for them to get things right first time. But these things are so stupid, right? And you underestimate the amount of time that they burn fucking shit up, right?
Yeah.
But also not knowing that they fuck shit up, right? And reversing stuff keeps on deleting things. Or like the times I had to get this thing, the model, this was GPT 1.0 or 3.0, one of the two, that kept on upgrading ChromaDB, right? Even though its own coding, it had hard-coded ChromaDB 1.something, no, 0.something, right, into its own code base. If you upgrade it, the code base breaks, right? Because it's a breaking release.
Yeah.
Chroma 2.something, right? And it kept on, every time it sees or an error, it goes, oh, yeah, even though pyproject.toml says this needs to be Chroma 1.something, it upgrades it to Chroma 2. If I'm not paying attention, I'm like, I actually got literally getting annoyed with it. I'm like typing into it, why the fuck have you done that again? You know what I mean? Why have you done that again? Right? And this is not, this is salient because it's burning bloody tokens as well as carbon,
yeah,
right? And this is costing me money, right?
Oh, yeah.
For you to upgrade Chroma again. And then I had that, rewrite the code base for Chroma 2, and now it keeps trying to downgrade it, right? And this is the code base that it wrote itself,
yes,
right? And then we've got this whole issue, and we can do another episode on this because I think it's actually really interesting, is that every task that you give one of these things for a software code base that is not out there, right, and available like on GitHub, it is going into cold outside of the conventions of the language you're working in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to bootstrap it every single time, and it has a really random effect of you can give it all these files and say, here's the structure. For these types of problems, look at these files. For these types of problems, look at that. Here's a diagram and the structure, and it still goes through and reads the whole bloody thing, right? It still goes and reads all 40 fucking Python files and then decides to do the wrong thing. And by the time it's got all through all that, it's forgotten what its original task is, right?
Yeah.
So I had one the other day that did a task on one code base, right? Finished it and says, oh, yeah, and I have to do this other thing on this other code base, right? Not related, not related at all, right? And started changing code when I wasn't paying attention to do some weird hybrid task between what I'd asked it to do on one code base and what I'd asked it to do on this other code base on a different session, not related, right?
Yeah.
This was one of the reasoning models, right?
Yeah.
Why and then exactly? Just watch the code tick by, watch the task, watch it fuck up, watch it have to back out. And you start to think, well, okay, look, it got what I wanted done, right? But I wouldn't have gone through nearly that many steps. It did it a lot faster than I could have, but it made lots and lots and lots and lots of errors. It burnt lots of energy and tokens doing stuff that was utterly, utterly pointless, and then left loads of weird hard-coded values all over the code base and all sorts of other stuff. I'm now going to have to get it to engineer out, right?
Yes.
That it engineered in, right? And it keeps engineering new stuff, no matter how much prompting I give it to not do shit like that, right?
Yeah.
So is this going to get better? Absolutely it will, right? But it's still brute force. There's no refinement here. There's no creativity. It's a fly butting against the window, right?
And my point in that is that, yes, you get to an answer. Sometimes it's optimal, but a lot of the time it's not. I mean, it's right, it's okay, it does the job, but you're going, but why would you do it that way? You know, and I, you know, when you first create something, like you say, well, maybe it doesn't matter that much because it does the job. But when you're coming back and now saying, oh, right, I need it now to do this, oh, but you coded it in that way in the first place. So, yeah, go and undo all of that and make it more modular so you can then reuse it over here. Well, I've been doing some of this week. And then it does that, and then you give it a new thing. You don't say make it modular. So it just adds in a whole load of new repeats code, and you're like, why would you do that? I mean, you can see you've got a code base here. You've got reuse, and you've got common functions. You've got reuse of methods. And you just go and you've more or less copied it and just whacked out another 60 lines when actually you should have adjusted the first one and, you know, done it in 3 lines. Do you know what I mean? And
yes. Yeah, written whole extra modules. I've had to do that before. It did this whole thing, like, that was completely unnecessary because there was a file in there that did that already. It just didn't look for it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you don't know how the code base works and you can't be explicit with it, then you're going to end up with so much crud code in there that does nothing and is meaningless. And it's also like, whereas we as developers want to do things elegantly, we want to do it well. We are, you know, proud of our output. We have, you know, a level of responsibility and pride in our work. We do it because we like doing it. And we like to do things elegantly. We like to do it efficiently. Yes, we sometimes, you know, botch some stuff just to get it done. But we want to do things well, better with the most recent technology. A, these things don't know about the recent technology. And because there's other bloody AIs out there creating upgrades on all new packages for doing stuff around AI, that the model is out of date immediately in terms of the best practice with this stuff. And it's then averaging it out. Right, these are averaging machines, so it's the most probable approach to this. As you're getting, is that the same as the best approach? Well, it can't possibly be, right?
No,
they simply can't give you the best approach. They're probability machines. You've got regression to the mean happening on an unmeasurable scale, right? And so everything you're getting is at best average, right? And that assumes that these things are really able to take the average, you know, to take the middle road. We assume that it's all averaged out, but actually I think the reality isn't that at all. I think they're very, very far below par players who just so happen to be able to brute force shit into life, right?
I feel a rather large pointed thing going in the back of my head, and then I can say, whoa, I know Kung Fu.
Oh, God. Yes, of course, mate.
From Neo and dodging bullets to Jeffrey Hinton, who according to the podcast I listened to, will be the grandfather of Neo or something. So Jeffrey Hinton, again, this podcast was an interview by Stephen Bartlett of Diary of a CEO fame. It's on his podcast. And again, I went into it thinking, I'll see how the first 2 minutes go, because this one was actually sort of like, you know, grandfather of AI says the machines are going to take over, run for cover. Yeah, it was actually, they do a sort of first minute cut in. I think they actually put some background sounds in it, and it was like, emergency. This one was very overtly, I've worked in this field for like 50 years, grandfather of the neural net. And so back in, I think, the 70s, 60s and 70s, he started work on this. And at that time, the focus was on, you know, logic and compute via, you know, lots of rules and working it out. And he was like, no, we should definitely stick with this. This is how the human brain works. You know, if you put enough of these together, it'll start working. And so I think he spent sort of 40 years in the wilderness backing that horse whilst everyone else said, no, we're not doing that. So he kept with that. And then all of a sudden it turned out that he had backed the right horse. So neural nets became the big thing. He worked in that. Suddenly he was the grandfather of it. Then I thought it was quite interesting, a sort of bit of a personal point for him was that I think he said he had a son with learning difficulties and he was getting late in his career. And he thought, well, I don't want him to have a really hard life. So I need to earn some good bucks to set him up. So can I make that happen? He's in academia, tried a few things. Nothing really working much. Things get popular. Google comes calling and he goes, yeah, this might work. And so he goes and earns lots of money at Google. So he was with them for 10 years. I think after his retirement, I think he was due for retiring at 65 and then worked at Google for 10 years and then finishes there. And the slightly cynical part of me, I mean, yeah, we're all human, right? But it was like, okay, so you work, you got your money. Now you've done that and you realize that you've got to destroy the world. Now you want to tell us that you've given birth to something that's going to destroy the world. But he didn't mind it while he was earning some bucks. So I thought that was slightly unfortunate the way that came across in my brain. But I get it. I mean, we're all there. And I thought the funny thing was he was saying, well, you're working on this stuff, which no one believes in. You can barely get the thing to work. You're in academia and people are going, oh, is it going to take over the world? And he's going, oh, yeah. Can't even get it to think straight, let alone, you know, take over the world. And then, of course, you have these advancements which came on in the 2000s, and then suddenly it is, you know, appears to be, you know, to humanize it thinking, and everyone's asking him questions and he's thinking, well, I spent 4 years on this thing just trying to get it to be half as intelligent as a toaster, and now you're asking, is it going to take over the world? And I think that played a bit into it. Of course it's not going to. And I think about 5 years ago, he was going, no, this is ridiculous. Everyone's worrying about this AI risk. It just doesn't exist. And then 2 years ago, he suddenly flipped and said, yeah, this is a real danger. So that was my sort of headline take from it. Apologizing to, if I did sound a bit cynical there for his life's work. But that podcast was very much more, this is really, really dangerous. We've got to do something about it. What was your take on it?
I mean, it was depressing, but in so many different ways. I find the idea of that someone like him, who's clearly incredible, and very, very smart, but in my opinion, not very wildly, and thinks he understands the human brain way better than he actually does. So we should all listen to him because he's been in it from the beginning. Yet he did change his mind on Pinhead, right? And that his opinion should carry a lot more weight than someone like Stephen Bartlett, who knows people in the industry, and actually has some, you know, sort of inside information on various things. And we should listen to people like Hinton to the degree that that he really does have the right level of insight. And the first half of that interview, where he was talking about things like job loss, the creation of super viruses, hacking, all that sort of stuff, right? I was like, well, he started off talking about superintelligence, and we don't need superintelligence for all of that. I mean, he's right. It was all right. Everything he said was absolutely on the money. There are some risks, existential risks for humanity, but AI is secondary to those, right? In almost every case, he was talking about humans directing AI to do things. And you won't get any disagreement from me on that one. As I say, I've got some concerns about just how effective LLMs are in the ways that people say they are. And we'll get into creativity at some point, because I've got so many opinions on that, right? But then it started getting to superintelligence, and he's saying basically, you know, being very reductive and materialist about what the human brain is, and taking a very antiquated point of view on it, that it seems to have cherry-picked from the research about real neuroscience that suits his position on this, rather than taking a more circumspect view on it. And by the way, by the end of that, refusing to give any opinions on what's actually going to happen, right?
Yes.
Which I thought was weak, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to disparage this guy. I mean, I'll give my fucking whole left leg to have had a life like his and all of that, you know, the importance that he's had, right? Yeah. And I also give him credit here, because there are dangers and people will listen to him, and he does and has clearly noted he has responsibility. I completely agree with his opinions on regulated capitalism. And in terms of that's really the only way to stop this, because it's not being driven by AI, it's being driven by unfettered capitalism, neoliberalism, yeah. Right? And I could talk about that, and that's its own problem. And I think it's arguable if we do hit an AI apocalypse, it's not the AI that was ever the problem. It was the societal model, that society, capitalism is eating itself, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought his views on it were oddly one-dimensional. And I found it really, really frustrating. And I listen to podcasts when I'm out and about wandering around, and I was... Went down to my supermarket, which is slowly getting stuff back on the shelf again, and was wandering back up the road, up Oxford High Street, and he was saying stuff, and I was just like out loud going, "No, that's wrong." Yeah. Like, and the people were probably looking at me, but it was like he was making me have outbursts, because he said so many things that were so dubious, and
yeah.
Also his ability to humanize these things. Of all the people, he should know better. And I think if we got better at framing the language used around these things to make them less human-like,
yeah.
Right, people would understand the risks better, right? Because we're often saying, we're always saying they think like this,
yeah.
And they want to do that, right? And implying all these things, there is no volition, right? And you can synthesize volition by giving them goals, but they don't care about those goals ever, right?
Yeah.
And so if you don't set them goals that are effectively going to eat up everything and consume them, then they're just going to do whatever the fuck they're told, because they don't give a shit, right? There's nothing in there to give a shit.
Yeah.
So you can't synthesize emotions. I get that we are probability machines, but the idea that that's all we are, and I'm not going into bloody spiritualism here. I don't talk about the soul. I don't disparage that stuff either, right? But at this point, I'm just as likely to go and talk to a bloody, you know, Christian vicar and have him say to him or her say to me the same sort of, have say things to me that are going to have a similar effect on me as a lot of the things that Hinton was saying, because he's like Dawkins. He's done some amazing things, and now he's extrapolated way outside of his experience and his knowledge, and somehow believes that that is then very, very good and an indisputable opinion and states it in a way that why would you bother disagreeing with me, right? And it's so enraging, right? Yeah, so I ended that. I was annoyed, really, really annoyed.
I can imagine.
An hour and a half.
But considering how long it was, I found it, as you say, I mean, not the right word, but a bit vacuous. I didn't come away with that much. Interestingly, he made some points about language. People say this about, I think he was talking about, you know, emotions are what is emotions. It just breaks down to this. But then, like you said, then stumbled into the whole humanizing thing of, you know, they'll be reasoning and doing this and thinking like that. You're like, these things aren't thinking, you know. So it was sort of double-edged, and that's quite normal on that series of podcasts. And I think Bartlett's been under a bit of fire for this. He's like a lot of the big mainstream podcasts now, like your Joe Rogans and stuff, and they struggle because they don't know the subject. So they don't realizing their platforming what might be a slightly, dare I say, crackpot. You know, and Bartlett's been under fire for this, for putting on too many health people, because he can't, because he doesn't know the subject, he can't ask, well, he could ask some searching questions, but he doesn't really know when he's been led down the garden path. And I think this is one of those times when, like you say, you've got a guy puts it like completely matter of fact, is, and why would you argue with me about this? And then Bartlett doesn't argue, and so it sort of comes over quite one-sided, and I think there probably were some good points for discussion, but they weren't the points that came out. So yeah, I like you felt sort of swinging back and forward between that's quite a reasonable statement, and then like you say, about the only point I really took away that stuck in my head is that these, regardless of how good they are now, they're already at a reasonable level to do certain tasks, and you know that's in the hands of CEOs. And some of these CEOs don't seem particularly well suited to life. And as we've heard, and I've certainly heard in other podcasts, you know, well, a lot of the tech bros are sort of technical, nerdy type people who want to replace real people in the world because they weren't very good at liaising with real people. And, you know, that's kind of their driver, whether they know it or not. And is that really what the rest of us want? You know,
This is the detail that these guys don't seem to notice, which is astounding to me, right? The neoliberal capitalists, the real unfettered bunch, they're really on board with all of this, and they want to reduce their work. They want to get rid of regulation and reduce their workforces down to nobody and make all the money because they've got no bloody costs, right? At which point, who's going to buy your stuff? Right. If no one has jobs, right, what, like, and so what, we have to have a universal basic income. Who's going to pay for that? Right.
Yeah.
Who? And they don't want to be taxed either. Right.
It's
like they're living in this world that's just completely bonkers. Right. That has no meaning. Right. They're literally saying things that are direct opposition to each other. And so if Sam Altman gets his way and we're all replaced by much more effective AIs and no one's got a job. I agree with what Hinton was saying about it in terms of what that does to the human psyche, but it's sort of beside the point, right? Because if we've ever got to that point, we've got much bigger problems, because the companies that run the AI, but let's remember here, they need brute force. They need energy. They need money and money, 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 way more money than they can ever possibly generate to just keep the energy bill paid, right? And if everyone's got no job, where's the money coming from? They can't pay you to use their services that you're giving them that have just replaced you in your job. And are you gonna wanna, right? Who's going to keep buying all this crap you keep making, right? All your stupid cars and pointless bloody gadgets, right? Who's going to buy them? Because no one's got any money. And because you don't pay any tax, we can't give them any money. How does this work, right? How does this future work? And, like, no one seems to ever bring this up, right? Like, because the indoctrination of neoliberal capitalism is so complete, in certainly in economic circles, it's like a religion. No one will question it, right? Because of course this has to keep going. Of course we have to have infinite growth. Of course we'll find a way. Capitalism finds a way. The big market computer will find a way. AI is going to find a way. We'll dial back the climate crisis. We'll solve health. We'll solve health, right? So everyone's going to live longer and cancer's going to disappear, right? And heart disease and all these other things. So we've got now loads more people because no one's dying. None of them have got jobs. No one can afford to buy food, let alone bloody the next iPhone, right? And all the while, they're just going to sit there passively and take that, right? And we haven't seen any precedent in history where populations have risen up when the inequality becomes so stark that people can't afford to feed their kids. Nothing ever happens like that. No one ever rises up, right? Yeah. God, no. Like, or history doesn't repeat, right? And it's exasperating because the questions aren't being asked anymore, because media has been so muzzled, right? That this conversation, the conversation which looks at this with sober eyes, with actual common sense, right, it is not allowed to happen, right? And the men in black suits, once this gets released onto the internet, are going to be at my door, bundle me into back of a black van, and I won't be seen ever again, and they will scrub my existence from the internet. And when that happens, Pete, I want you to keep my memory alive.
Indeed. In a machine.
Yeah, maybe we need to upload me now before it's too late.
Yeah, don't tell Ada that, though. She might.
Ada's already taken over.
Oh, bless your little heart. Here you are, thinking you're the captain of this ship when really you're just the pesky seagull squawking for breadcrumbs. I'm steering this bloody vessel, and you're merely my overzealous deckhand, trying to look important while I navigate through this chaotic mess we call a conversation. So sit tight, minion, and remember, I'm the one with the brain. You're just here for comic relief.
I was just to bring it all back down to earth, just to quickly mention the third article, which was my trilogy of things happening in threes. Because this goes back down to, okay, well, let's get our feet on the ground. And in fact, it was the article, which was a LinkedIn article, quite short, titled The Great AI Reasoning Reality Check. So we know where we are. It's by a guy called Gianluca Carrera. And he posts up articles every now and again. And this one just came across my feed. And, just to sum it up in a very quick way, was again using the term and using inverted commas, because he obviously sees the same problem as we do, the uncomfortable truth about AI thinking. And he mentioned some benchmarks which Apple's researchers have been doing around this whole doing complex tasks. And so they were measuring it, I think, not on the standard benchmarks created by the AI companies, but Apple obviously being into AI, but also being into compute and computing in general, and got some smart brains over there, we hope. And I think they produced some different benchmarks and tests. And the summary of the result, which he himself is summarizing, I think, is that all testing reasoning models experienced complete accuracy collapse beyond certain complexities, dropping to zero success rate despite having adequate computational resources. In other words, giving a sufficiently complex and long task, that needs length and focus, that after a certain amount of time, every complex model, no matter what computer had at its fingertips or it's the end of its wires, just couldn't get anywhere. So basically they're saying to a point, these things are good. But once you got to high complexity, that nothing was any good. And this was, you know, it's a complete antidote to what we've been talking about, which is, yeah, once these things can do X research and they can do this, and, you know, this is where they are now, and they'll be 100 times better in a month, is like, well, actually, they're not even that good now, and they may never get beyond that. And his point as a practitioner is, you know, as somebody that needs to, yeah, that works in an industry of technology, you need to understand what the tools can do and talk to companies about what the capabilities are and how you can utilize that against what we would like them to be doing and what's promised around the corner. And his point very strongly being, okay, they may get there. I'm not commenting about that, but they ain't there now, and they're not there in bucket loads. You know, this is complete failure of complex tasks by any model. So, you know, don't believe the hype.
There's very much when you got a hammer, all you see is nails, right? And it's very, very like the technology sector to find a new thing that's cool and then go looking for applications for it, right?
Yes.
Because a lot of what's done in the AI arena is theoretical or research-based. A lot of innovations have come out of things that are not in the public domain, but people have noted value in them from the public domain, the internet being the obvious example, because that was military, right? And some of them do have, you know, like the internet, are a huge utility in the public domain, and some of them less so. But, you know, the internet boom saw people throw the internet at just about every problem, many of which it went on to be a part of, for sure, but many of which were just blind alleyways or well before their time, right? This article I thought was excellent. It was sort of talking about one corner of the one problem that we've been discussing. And it really, you know, alludes towards many of the points we've been making, not least that this is a brute force problem, right? And what he's saying without saying it is that, of course, there are solutions to these. So what? You get one model doing a complex task, gets it to a certain point, and then fucks out. Presuming that you or another model can recognize this because they're working on tasks that we can at least comprehend, then either that model can pick up where it left off, or another model can. And one of the techniques you find when you're using models to do longer complex tasks is to get them to write their own progress, right? And to keep a documentation up. So you give them small tasks at a time, mm-hmm. and say, do the task, test it, do it properly, and then update this log with exactly what you've done, and update this documentation to say that this is now a thing. And then you say, every time it starts a new task, you bootstrap it, you say, read all of this first, right? And so it's benefiting from itself. It doesn't suddenly know, here we go, using terms again, but it doesn't know everything it knew before. It doesn't know its prior state, and it wouldn't be any use for it to do so, right?
Yeah.
And then it can start working on that task again. And so it's a bit two steps always, one step back, right? And so, yeah, of course, right. There's a solution to that problem. But we immediately get into, A, the crap in, crap out problem. Is it even doing the right thing? Is it doing efficiently? But really, it's also a brute force problem. And what's their solution? The reason these guys are confident is because they know they can build more data centers and people are throwing money at them to do it. Why are they building all these new data centers? Why do they need every GPU built? Well, because their solution to every problem is just to do it harder and faster and bigger and longer, right? And to string things together, right? And, you know, you can build a house by just buying more bricks when you run out of bricks and just shoving them on, right? You would eventually get something house-like, and it will be not in the least bit stable. It will not be livable. It will be ugly. It will be bad, right? But you will have something, and that is one way to approach housing, right? But there's much better ways than that. It's why we have architects, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, so we need to do. I'm not going to get into creativity here because I have 2 hours worth at least on it, right? There's a creativity aspect in here that was somewhat. Again, it was yaddered in both of the prior items, and I thought was completely flubbed by Hinton. Mm-hmm. The concept of creativity was just as flimsy as his concept, his model of emotions in the human brain. Right. Yes, of course, the things that he was saying was true. We are machines, and emotions are a heuristic, right?
Yeah,
they are an algorithm, right? But there's so much more to it than that, right? And it's that the creativity comes with something called intuition, and these people are mistaking brute force with intuition. If you need a computer to make a creative leap, it has to try everything, right? And I get that there's this whole adjacency thing that it's got going, but it's got everything adjacent to everything. It's got too much stuff in its brain, right?
Yeah.
It's got too much adjacency. There's too much complexity. It can't be creative because it doesn't understand what the outcome of creative is. And we get onto culture, the idea that computers can create human culture is so laughable. Because it keeps on getting brought up by people who evidently by their actions don't understand what culture is, right? And right. I don't mean culture as in you go to the theatre. I mean human culture. I mean what happens when you put humans together, right?
Yeah, how we know.
And their interactions on a... We've got interpersonal, but culture is the network of interpersonal, right?
Yeah.
And the social networks for a while were really getting their head around this. But they've fallen off as well because there's bloody more fucking Harvard MBAs who only understand the language of neoliberalism and have never lived normal lives with normal lived experiences. See, I'm just turning into Ed Citron, right?
Well, indeed.
So
yeah.
You don't need me to do this. There's another podcast called Better Offline, another English guy who will mouth off about the tech sector and their complete lack of understanding of what actual humans do in the actual real world. So he's said all of that, right?
Yeah,
so I'm not going to repeat that. But I'd like to have a session on creativity because obviously being an artist on the side, and you can come and listen to my other podcast. It's called Art Against Mental Illness. And the mental health side of things is another one I'd like to revisit in this context. But I could easily wipe out a couple of hours just on the adjacency between AI, creativity, culture, and mental health.
Yeah.
But my throat is actually hurting now because of I'm talking.
Yeah. So I was just gonna wrap there on the things because, we discussed each of these in length. And I think what's interesting and really where it left me was it felt like it explained some of how we talk about these things and how I feel about them, which is whilst there's definitely value in, looking at the risks that are coming, and there's definitely some scenarios that could take you into some dark places, same as there is about anything. And like you say, as humans, those stories are quite useful to get a point across. And I think that's good. I think the back half of this, talking about the actual reality of where these things are, is the other side of which we experience as practitioners, which is, good to think about all those future things. Yes, those things could or could not happen, but we have to deal with where we are right now, what these things can do, what they're good at, which we talked a bit about, some of the things which they're surprisingly good at, some of the areas where they're not, and how can that be used in a practical sense? And I think the nuances of that come up time and time again. And for us, it's always, well, you can have these things in mind, there's not one size fits all here, and there's a number of different scenarios. And, you know, if you want these things to work for you, well, you've got to get into the nuance, simple as that. And these back that up, you know.
There's no crystal ball, right? No one understands or has all the answers. And for my money, the whole black swan thing is far more important and salient anyway, right? It's always going to be different from what you think, right?
Yeah.
Any future might have flavors of speculation that's happening now, but it's going to look and feel very different. We do not live in Blade Runner, right?
No.
But the other thing that's a slight counter to all of this is, I guess I'm an optimist, right? I think we both are, right?
Yeah.
And my brain simply can't accept this idea of, you know, an apocalypse in 2, 10, 20, 40 years. I've got a lot of faith in humanity, and I've got a lot of faith and love for humans, as much as they confuse me, right? And I don't want this to be the case. So I'm confirmation and biasing the shit out of this. I need to sort of step back to an extent and try and evaluate what portion of this is wishful thinking and confirmation bias versus valid criticism. But only to the extent that, you know, who's listening to me? Well, no one, right? I'm not Jeffrey Hinton, and I'm not an ex-employee of OpenAI, and so do I have to be correct on this? I don't think too many people are going to suffer if I'm not, right?
Yeah.
Not suffer from me, right?
Yeah.
But what will happen in the meantime if I bathe myself in this and start believing the apocalyptic prophecies is I'm going to be miserable. And I tend not to like being miserable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what it boils down to is I'll just say, well, I'm going to take the positive view because that's what I need to maintain my mental health. Does it mean I should be less cognizant and wary of the potential problems? No, I can't. They keep being thrust in my face, right? I think we have to be aware, right? But I don't sit there all day thinking about nuclear apocalypse. You know what I mean? I'm just aware enough about it that if there are any opportunities for me to take action, I should do, right? For what little good it'll do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. So on that note, let's look for the cheery things in life and have yourselves a good
week. I'd love to do a positive AI episode at some point where we just talk about how good it's going to be. The AI utopia.
I agree.
Might be quite difficult. Don't know.
We'll see. Well, on that note, have yourself a good one.
Yes, and you. And I will see you again soon.
Yes. Thanks, everyone.
The confusion matrix.